And this is, in fact, in red in the transparency because it's the topic which I'm going to discuss today. So the tool that we use to describe, to achieve to get our solutions is based on a first principle analysis of the relevant Killing-Spinor equations, which are the variations of the various fermionic fields in a supergravity theory, such that they are put to zero so that there is some unbroken supersymmetry preserved. So examples of Killing-Spinor equations, of course, the simplest one one can think of is the one where the spinor is covalently constant, and this is the case of special holonomy, which people are familiar with. So there are Calabi-Yau manifolds, G2 manifolds, and so on. The next, perhaps the next two simple example is if you have a one gamma term in this equation, and this is the case, for instance, in Lorentzian signature for Killing-Spinor on ADS, and it's also the case for Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, which I'm going to discuss in the second part of the talk. So the tool that we will be using, we have used, and to construct these solutions is based on something which has been called G-structures method, and which was originally proposed in a paper with Jerome Gauntlet, Statis Pakis, and Dan Waldron. So I'm not going to discuss today here the technicalities of these tools, because I want to go straight away to the results and to the solutions we have. So roughly speaking, we have some geometrical data, which consists of some tensor fields, some forms, vector fields, defined on a Riemannian manifold, possibly also in Lorentzian manifold if we are interested in a more general context. And the Killing-Spinor equations then impose some conditions on these forms, and so we have a particular type of group structure. So an example here, just to finish off this discussion of these structures, is given by having a spinor which obeys this equation here, which corresponds to the case of Kalem manifolds. So there are spinor fields obeying this equation here. So in a fancier language, we say that there is a UN structure which is completely integrable. So first of all, I want to give a summary of the results, so those of you who could get bored along the way know already the results. And also it serves as a plan of the rest of, for the rest of the talk. So I'm going to discuss 11-dimensional supergravity solutions which are supersymmetric and have an ADS5 factor in the metric, and some byproducts of this analysis, most notably the Sasaki-Einstein metrics in 5 dimensions, which we found. So the first result is a geometrical characterization of all supersymmetric solutions of this type, which is necessary in order to proceed. And secondly, I'm going to discuss how we found many new solutions in explicit form, imposing an additional condition on the geometry, which is more or less natural. In particular, we impose that the six-dimensional space is also admissible to a complex, integral complex structure. So with this condition, in fact, one can classify all possible solutions, not only classify, but also find in explicit form, in closed form, and they turn out to fall into two different classes. One is in which there is a base manifold, which is a Keller-Einstein, which admits a Keller-Einstein metric, and one is in which the base manifold is scalar, but it is the product, direct product of two Riemann surfaces with a constant curvature and with non-Einstein metric. So this second case here will be the springboard for the second part of the talk, because in the case in which one of these two Riemann surfaces is a torus, one can do a reduction in T-duality, so one can duality chase to type 2b and find new supersymmetric solutions, which, as it turns out, are Sasaki-Einstein metrics. So This will be the subject of the second part of the talk, describing in detail the some properties of this Sasaki-Einstein matrix. And finally, I will make some comments, of course, because now we have new explicit examples of supersymmetric solutions, which are the form ADS5 cross an internal manifold, which are supersymmetric. We obviously would like to identify the field theory duals, which will be n equals 1 superconformal field theories in four dimensions. And that was, in fact, perhaps the main motivation for the whole work. And lastly, I would like to mention that in a subsequent publication, which is this one, with the same authors, we extended the construction of the Sasaki-Einstein manifolds to any dimension. So the most interesting, although this is very interesting mathematically, but for physics, of course, the most interesting part is that there are also seven-dimensional examples which can be used as supersymmetric background in 11 dimensions now with the Freund-Rubin type of ansatz, and they should be dual to superconformal field theory in three dimensions. Oh, that's just for the definition of Sasaki-Einstein. They just live in odd dimensions. I'll just come to them later, yeah. Okay, so let's get started. These are just a summary of the rules of the game that we play. 11-dimensional supergravity has a metric and a four-form flux field. And we are interested in solving this particular equation here with a particular ansatz for the metric, which is this one. And pretty much that's it. We don't impose any other restrictions. So I want just to mention that one has to impose, of course, apart from supersymmetry, also the Bianchi identity and the equations of motion for G and the Einstein equations in principle. I come to this point later. So the flux is completely arbitrary. And the spinor is also completely arbitrary, subject to the fact that the external spinor is a spinor in ADS, obeying this equation here. And the internal spinor is non-chiral. Now, this non-chiral condition, which is quite important, it's a technical condition, which I'm not going to discuss in detail here, but it's a key point which allows to make progress. In fact, if you take the spinor to be chiral, one quickly realizes that the solutions we are interested in don't exist because the flux must be zero and the external space must be flat and one can have just Calabi-Yau matrix in the internal space.
When you say the flux is arbitrary, are you still preserving the ADS5 symmetry?
Yeah, I mean arbitrary preserving ADS5 symmetry, yeah. It's arbitrary in the internal space and there are no legs in the external space. Of course. So we better use this non-chiral spinor if we want to make any progress. So if you do that, it's pretty much easy to see that this non-chiral spinor defines naturally an SU2 structure, at least locally, on the six-dimensional internal manifold. And the reason is that if you have only one spinor that defines an SU3, if you have another one which is linearly independent, their intersection somehow defines an SU2 for you. So what I mean by SU2 structure here in practice is that you have two vectors or their dual one forms which naturally split the space in 4 plus 2. And in the remaining four directions, there is a natural hyperchiral structure given by a triplet of complex structure which obey the algebra of equatorians. So in an SU2 language, one can take these three two forms and write as a real two form, which is the almost scalar two form, and a complex 2,0 form. The additional key ingredient in the game is a function which is hanging around everywhere, and which is basically the norm of the spinor. So that's another thing that one has to do, is to allow the spinor to have arbitrary norm, not to normalize it. Otherwise, again, the system doesn't have solutions apart from flat space and Calabi-Yau. So given these assumptions here, well, not the assumptions, given this structure here, one do, does some work, some various computations, which eventually lead to these results. So one can introduce a canonical form of the, for the metric, which is this one. So there is a Killing vector, which is one of these two guys here. In particular, it's called K2 in the paper. And there is an additional direction, Y, corresponds, roughly speaking, to this K1. And the remaining space, which is denoted M4, turns out to be Kähler. So these are the conditions defining the remaining space. So it's a Kähler manifold. So far, so good. But then there are slightly non-trivial equations that this object has to satisfy in order to correspond to have a fully supersymmetric condition. So I call them dynamical because there is some sort of evolution of the structure in four dimensions along the y direction. Okay. And finally, one of the points of this type of constructions is that one doesn't have to worry about the flux because the flux is completely fixed in terms of the geometry. So this is almost true because, in fact, what one has to do is to, if one wants to find solutions, take the flux and make sure that, in fact, it solves the Bianchi identity and equations of motion. So this is quite unpleasant in general, and then one is stuck at that point. However, in this case, we are quite lucky, and we can make progress because it turns out that for these particular classes of solutions, supersymmetry also implies all the remaining equations, including the Bianchi identity. So good, we can't forget completely about the flux, and we have just to, if we want to find solutions now, we have just, well, just in quote marks, to solve these equations here. Well, this is still a system which is a bit complicated. So in order to find a really explicit example, one can make additional assumptions. And that's what we did. So in general, one requires the, all of that was local analysis. So in general, one requires also the solutions to be, the internal manifolds to be compact and non-singular, and hopefully also new, otherwise there is no point. So this is what one requires in general. Now here also, by hand, if you want, there is no reason to do that in principle, and in fact there are also counter examples. But if one requires that the internal manifold also be complex with respect to a natural complex structure inherited from the this object here. It turns out that the conditions I've shown you before simplify quite drastically, and one is able to find all the solutions to those equations. So in particular, all the dependents on the coordinates on the Kähler manifold disappear, so everything is independent of the coordinates on the Kähler manifold, which are denoted here with the 4. And so there is only one variable in the game, which is this y variable. And also this term rho, which I just remind you was a term appearing in the metric in this form, it now becomes naturally identified with the connection with the connection on the canonical bound of the Kähler manifold. So now we have a system for this variable lambda of y, and possibly the metric, the Kähler manifold also has some functions which depend on y. So we have a coupled, by two equations. I don't mean really two. I mean, like, there are two equations. One of them is an equation for a form, so there are more equations hidden in it. So now, requiring the metric to be smooth, this implies certain general properties about the topology of the manifolds that we have. And this comes about this way because we have this metric here. And so the internal, sorry, the Bayes Kähler manifold, we want it to be smooth, of course. And the remaining two coordinates, y and psi, we want them to parameterize a smooth manifold so that, in fact, locally, we want it to be like a two-sphere. So when these functions, for instance, this function cos square of zeta goes to zero, we want to be able that near this pole, the metric is free of conical singularities. So that, in fact, it's topologically just a two-sphere at the two poles. So we would like also this function to be to range between two zeros. All of this, in fact, is going to happen for our solutions. I'm not talking randomly. So given this requirement, it's easy to see then that what we have here is a S2 bundle or CP1 bundle over the Kähler manifold to make our full six-dimensional manifold. So all solutions we find will be different metrics on the same space, more or less. It's also easy to see, to characterize this bundle in terms of like the band of units of dual forms. It's just a curiosity. Which, by the way, is not the twister space, so don't get confused. Okay, so to find these solutions, we now use a couple of lemmas and theorems in order to make sure that we're not missing anything. So the lemma is easy to check. So one can see, given the equations that we presented before, one can check that the Ricci tensor of M4 has two constant pairs of eigenvalues. And then, quite curiously, one can use a very recent work in differential geometry, which appeared in this paper, which is on the Math Archive, which tells us that if this lemma is true, then it must be necessarily one of these two cases. So either the four-dimensional space admits a Kähler-Einstein metric, or it must be a direct product of two Riemann surfaces. If there is any expert here, I'm also used in the Goldberg conjecture. So we are assuming that. Okay. So now, given that the Kähler manifold must be of this particularly simple form, we have now a very natural answer to use for the four-dimensional metric in terms of some functions of y, which together with this function lambda, which was the warp factor, I recall, they now make a system of first-order ODEs, which are yet non-linear. So in principle, this is normally the best one can do. The problem is reduced to a first-order system of equations, and whether one can integrate them or not, it's not ensured. Well, it happens in this case, and in fact, it's pretty much straightforward to integrate them. So one is able to find all the solutions in closed form. Good. So now we have all the solutions, which means we have a bunch of functions. We just plug them into the metric, into the flux. And all we have to do now is to check that these solutions are regular. If they are singular, then we failed. In fact, it turns out that for some values of the integration constants which appear in these functions, the solutions are singular, but for some other values, in fact, are perfectly regular and well-defined solutions. So I'm, of course, not reporting on this slide those which are singular, but just those which are regular. And they happen to be, for the Kähler-Einstein case, this is true when its curvature is positive. So the cosmological constant is positive. And as an example, this is the type of functions which we encounter when we solve them. So they're just quite simple polynomials, or fractions of polynomials in this variable y, and they have some integration constant, which I'm not sure you can see. Is in blue. It's a C letter. So one can do this analysis and make sure that there are no curvature singularity, no conical singularities at the poles. And it turns out that for the range of C between 0 and 4, doesn't have any particular meaning. So there is a range for this, for which all the solutions are regular, they're compact, they're also complex, and they are S2 bound over Kähler-Einstein spaces. So this is already interesting. The next case is the case of the direct product, and we find that there are regular solutions in the case where the direct product consists of a product of two spheres, and a two-sphere and a hyperbolic space. So, well, this is not compact in general, but it is also a solution. So although we assume compactness, but we also find some solutions which are non-compact. And the last case is the most interesting one, perhaps, because this will be the springboard for the next part of the talk, which is about Psaki-Einstein. So when one of these two Riemann surfaces is a two torus, one should be happy because one can now do a reduction in a t-duality and obtain solutions in type 2b. So one can check what these solutions are. And that's what we'll do next. So we're now prepared to go from type 2, from M theory to type 2b. So this is the starting point. Let's recap. We have a solution which admits, which has in it in the metric a T2 cross S2. And you can recognize the S2 here in this term and the T2 here. And these two terms together make the S2 bundle, plus, of course, the ADS5. This is how this function cos look like. And that's the inverse of this above. The G-flux is given. We don't have to worry about it. It's not very nice, so it's not in the transparency. Now, this solution has a number of isometries. Namely, there is an SU2 cross U1 cubed, where U1 squared belongs to the torus, and there is a U1, which I call R, for the reason that it is associated to this direction psi, and it is associated to the R symmetry in the dual field theories. So just to make a point, notice that all these solutions have an ADS5 factor in 11 dimensions, so all of them should be in principle dual to four-dimensional conformal field theories. Although here the task is particularly hard because we don't have such a good understanding of M5 brain as for D3 brain. But in principle, there are CFT duals also to all of the solutions I've just presented. Okay, so coming back to this issue of the t-duality, I want to make a point here, is that given an isometry, one is not free to make a t-duality or a reduction, because if one does so, in general, supersymmetry is broken. So, of course, one is free if one gives up supersymmetry, but we don't want. So we want to retain supersymmetry at the level of supergravity. So here is a classical example, which is this famous S5 untwisted in a paper by Duff, Liu, and Pope of some years ago. And the example, in very short terms, is that if you take an S5, a round 5 sphere, you can view it as a U1 bundle over CP2. So one is very much tempted to do a t-duality along this U1 direction and obtain this way an untwisted version, which is CP2 cross U1, cross S1, which is a solution of type 2A. However, it is not supersymmetric. So this is an example of the fact that one has to be quite careful on the directions in which one does the t-duality. So that's the reason why we should be quite happy that there are additional U1 isometries apart from the one which every solution of the classic presented has. Okay, so we start, we do a reduction to type 2A, and we get this solution, which is very, very short, because we don't need the details, since I'm going to present just the T-dual version, which is in the next transparency. So here we have a solution, or at least we have a, in fact, we have a two parameters family of solutions of type 2B, which it is supersymmetric because we did the reduction along some safe directions. And it looks, it is very explicit. There is a bunch of metric functions, which we call W and Q, and they're given here and here. And this is one form, which is proportional to this term. And it's trivial to check that the dilaton is constant, and the phi form is just self-dual and proportional to the volume of ADS5. So this should immediately ring a bell, because it's quite well known that this type of solutions with constant dilaton, no three-form fluxes, and just this particular simple type of, if we want, Freund-Rubin type of five-form, it's well known to be Sasaki-Einstein. So the internal manifold has to be Sasaki-Einstein. So that's the summary. We found a family of a two-parameter family of ADS5 cross X5 solutions of type 2B supergravity. And there must be Sasaki-Einstein if we didn't make any mistake along the way. So what are they? That's the question. And the reason why this question is quite puzzling to begin with is that Sasaki-Einstein geometry is well studied, and as I'll show you in a moment, there aren't many examples on the market. So here I give a short summary of Sasaki-Einstein geometry and a recap of the state of the art for this particular type of geometries, at least in five dimensions. Okay, so the best definition, perhaps, which is very short for a Sasaki-Einstein manifold, is to say that if you take the metric cone, which is just defined by saying that this is the metric on the, this is the Sasaki-Einstein odd manifold, odd dimensional manifold, and this is now an even dimensional manifold, which is a cone. So it's singular at the tip of the cone. And if you require it to be Kähler and Ricci flat, so a Calabi-Yau, then it turns out that the base manifold is Sasaki-Einstein. So the Kähler condition is responsible for the S and the Ricci flat conditions for the E. So everyone knows that if you take the cone over the round S5, you get a flat six-dimensional space, which is obviously Calabi-Yau. And the next example is provided by so-called T11 manifold, whose cone is the well-known conifold. Okay. Now, what is a Sasaki-Einstein structure? So this is given for us by a constant norm Killing vector, and it's dual one form, which it's denoted eta here, and a non-degenerate two form such that it obeys this simple equation. So D of this one form is just proportional to this two form. Now, the reason why Sasaki-Einstein spaces are interesting in string theory is that they admit Killing spinors. In fact, one can define equivalently, given the existence of some theorems, one can define a Sasaki-Einstein manifold as one such that it admits Killing spinors, which in particular means spinors obeying these conditions, which appeared in perhaps the second transparency. So that's why Sasaki-Einstein manifolds in five dimensions are interesting in type 2B, and in seven dimensions are interesting in 11, in say, M theory. So before telling you what's the state of the art, I have to give some slightly more advanced notions of Sasaki-Einstein geometry, which sometimes physicists perhaps don't, I'm not immediately familiar with. So given that there exists this Killing vector, one can define naturally what mathematicians call a foliation, which in practice means that if you write the metric in these guys here, you can split naturally what, well, you can adapt the metric to the Killing vector In this way, so d by d psi is the Killing vector, and what remains left over is what's called this foliation. So it turns out that this foliation, or four-dimensional space, is Kähler-Einstein. So it admits a Kähler-Einstein metric. So please don't be confused. The cone is Ricci flat, whereas this four-dimensional part of the metric is Kähler-Einstein. Okay, so given this split, one can classify the various Sesarki-Einstein geometries in terms of the of this foliation, and they fall into three different classes. So one is called regular, and the one in which the Kähler-Einstein space, in quote marks, is in fact a smooth manifold. What's called quasi-irregular is a case in which this space happens to be an orbifold. So it's an orbifold with a Kähler-Einstein metric. The final, the third one, is called irregular, and it's the case in which the four-dimensional space, in quote marks, is in fact nothing. It's badly singular. If you try to identify it, it just turns out to be quite very singular. It's not even an orbifold. Okay? So this also ties in with the fact that for the first two cases, one can define very naturally the full Sesarki-Einstein manifold as a U1 bundle over a Bayes manifold, whereas in the third case, that's impossible because you can't take the quotient. Good, now I can tell you what's known about Sesarki-Einstein manifolds. Okay? So in the regular case, so just to avoid confusion, this regularity requirement have nothing to do with the smoothness of the manifolds. They're all smooth five-dimensional manifold and have different properties in terms of this Bayes manifold. So in the regular case, these are completely classified due to results of Tian and Yao, and the four-dimensional Bayes can be, of course, S2 crosses 2, CP2, or some Del Pezzo surfaces, which are denoted PK, with K between 3 and 8. So for the first case of S5, I just mentioned it before, one can view the Bayes manifold as a quotient of S5 over U1. For the second case, where the Bayes manifold is S2 crosses 2, and one takes the U1 bundle over it, it turns out to be T11. And the third, the other possibility in the regular case is to take Del Pezzo surfaces, and one can do that. That's very nice, but you don't have any metrics here to play with. Now, I must tell you that until 3 years ago, that was about it. That was it. There wasn't anything else around on the market. Then 3 years ago, mathematicians, most notably Boyer and Galitsky and collaborators, they came up with some algebraic geometric constructions in which using those constructions, one can show that there exist Sesarki-Einstein metrics on various manifolds, for instance, on various connected sum of S2 cross S3. And in particular, they show that there are 14 metrics, inequivalent metrics, on S2 cross S3. So they have this funny number, 14. But no metrics are written down, so you know that they exist. And you know, of course, some other properties about the defining polynomials and so on, but you don't have the metric as physicists like. The regular case is even worse because there are no examples at all. So although there is a nice definition of what an irregular Sesarki-Einstein manifold is, there isn't any example. So hang on, what's going on here? We have apparently infinitely many Sesarki-Einstein spaces, and how do they fit in this picture? So the regular cases are all known, so clearly we can't be in the regular case. The quasi-regular cases, there are just 14 metrics given by Boyer and Galitsky, and there are no irregular examples at all. So what is really going on? Okay, so now I'm trying to convince you, to show you that what we have here is in fact an infinite number of inequivalent metrics on S2 cross S3, which obviously fall in one of these categories, but they are new, so they are not on, they weren't previously known. So the strategy splits in two different parts. The first part is a local analysis, which is to make sure that supersymmetry is preserved and everything. And I hope somehow I have convinced you that this is already ensured, because we came from M theory and we did the T duality on directions which are good. So we have a supersymmetry. If I haven't convinced you, I'm going to do it in the next transparency with yet another argument. And then the second part of the analysis is a global analysis, which is trickier and requires a little bit more thought to deal with. Okay, so to finish off the first part, one can just do a change of coordinates. So you just take the metric, do a change of coordinates, and you can cast it in this form. So this is now explicitly in the form which I've shown you before, which every Sasaki-Einstein manifold, by definition, must have. So by definition, a Sasaki-Einstein manifold can be written, a metric on it can be written this way, and a change of coordinates shows that that's possible indeed for our metrics with this base manifold, which is this one. Well, sorry, I don't mean manifold yet, of course. This four-dimensional part of the metric is this one with this power, with this delta function here. Now, it turns out that these four-dimensional metrics were worked out some time ago by Gary Gibbons and Chris Pope, and precisely looking for Kähler-Einstein metrics in four dimensions. So locally, these are Kähler-Einstein metrics. So this ensures that our spaces are locally Sasaki-Einstein. What was known also is that these metrics are all singular, with some singularity of some type, except for the case where this term vanishes. So A is equal to 1, in which case the metric reduces to the Einstein metric on CP2. And obviously, the Sasaki-Einstein manifold, it's just S5. So those coordinates here in which the metric looks like this doesn't seem very promising to make progress and trying to make sense of the globally of these metrics. So one needs some clever trick or some luck, if you want. And that's provided by the M-theory coordinates. So one is going to work here with the coordinates which are naturally provided by the solutions in M-theory at the end of the duality cascade, I mean, just from this couple of reduction into duality. So we have a four-dimensional part, which is denoted here by ds squared b4, and there is this part here, which is given by this alpha Killing vector and this A type of term, which I just perhaps want to remind. So we work in these coordinates here, okay, where the metric looks like this. So what's now written like ds square of b4 is just the first terms of the metric. Well, please interrupt me if there is something not clear. So the strategy is now to show that this b4 here is a smooth manifold in general, so for any allowed value of this integration constants. And the second part would be to show that for some particular values of these integration constants, namely infinitely many integer numbers, this total space can be made into a U1 bundle over this base manifold B4. And so that answers the question of whether these metrics are globally defined and smooth and so on. And thirdly, we will identify the topology of the manifold. Sorry. Okay, so let's look at the point one. So the point one, now I have expanded this four-dimensional metric. And we, in fact, again, we already answered this question when we were looking at regularity in M theory. So this is just a repetition, just in the context of type 2A. But this sigma 1 and sigma 2 parameterize just the two sphere, which was in M theory, and this Y and sigma 3 parameterize just the two sphere bundle, which was sitting in M theory. So we showed before that the metric was completely regular, and of course, this is going to be true also after the reduction. So in practice, again, what one does, just check how these functions Q and W behave near the zeros and make sure that one can choose a suitable periodicity of this of a coordinate which sits inside here. So d psi is minus cos theta d phi. So in this sigma 3, it's hidden this term. So one can choose a periodicity of psi in such a way that this becomes a smooth two-sphere. So this obviously works, and we have that now we have an S2 bundle over S2. So it's non-singular, and that's what it is. Now, one obviously would like to ask what type of bundle is it? And this is quite standard. One can compute the first gen class of this bundle, and this turns out to be an even number, namely 2. So this implies that the base manifold is therefore a trivial bundle. So it's a direct product, although not with a direct product metric. So I just remind you briefly that there are just two types of S2 bundles over 2. And which are classified by this number according whether it is even or odd. And the odd case, in fact, corresponds to the Page instanton metric. So this is different. Now we go to the to this alpha direction and show that, in fact, so now there's a Bayes manifold which is smooth. And we would like to show that one can make the total space as a U1 vibration. This is, again, quite standard, and one should make sure that the curvature of this term is, when you integrate over the cycles of the base, the periods are proportional to some integers. So there is some natural quantization conditions where you show that there are some integers parameterizing the solution. And this is very much the same as in the case of which Gary Gibbons was talking about this morning for the Einstein metrics discovered by the Japanese group, in which case there were two integers parameterizing the solutions as well for the very same reason. Okay, so if you do that, there is some little number theory analysis which one can do. And the result is that there are infinitely many values for which this is possible. So this more or less finishes the proof that we have a smooth manifold and it's parameterized by two integers. So for those who are a little bit familiar with the TPQ spaces, these are they have exactly the same type of structure. These are all U1 bundle over S2 cross S2, and the P and Q numbers are related to the periods the integrated periods of the curvature over the two spheres. Also, this number L, which is a proportionality constant, is given by this combination, so that you can one can check that in fact. I think there is a mistake here. This probably, okay. Depends how you normalize, but anyway. So the canonical Killing vector is given by a linear combination of this d by the alpha vector and the d by the psi vector. So it means that in general, if this L is an irrational number, so you see there is a square root here. Can you see it? It's so it turns out that this is now, you have taken a square torus and you have rotated it, changed coordinates with some combination involving irrational numbers. So it, now in the new coordinates, using the new coordinates, you can't cover, you can't parameterize it in a good way. And it turns out that if you go along this new direction, you don't come back. So the orbits of this Killing vector, the canonical Killing vector of the Sasaki-Einstein manifold, don't close in general. They do if and only if this number L is integer. Sorry, it's rational. Okay, so this should convince you already that we have, in general, examples of irregular manifolds when these numbers are irrationals, and for particular cases, we have quasi-irregular manifolds. Obviously, we can't have regular manifolds because they're all known, and obviously, we don't have them here. So another reason to see immediately that we are, in general, in the irregular case, in this case here, is given by the volumes. So if one computes the volume by trivial calculation, these are given by this formula here, and as you can see, there are, again, square roots, so these are irrational numbers. Now, it's pretty much easy to see that quasi-regular and regular spaces, they have rational volumes, because for the reason that they can be viewed as U1 bundle over Kellner-Einstein orbifolds. So this is another reason, so, and it ties up with this discussion of the torus, which is parameterized in the wrong way. For the final point, which is a bit technical, and which I'm not going to discuss here, is the topology, the global topology of these manifolds. And it turns out, to make the story short, that these are all S2 plus S3. And the strategy to prove this is that choose P and Q to be coprime, so that one can show that the manifolds are all simply connected, and then using a classic result to Smale, which shows then, given another couple of ingredients in this story, one can show that they are all this type. So they're all S2 cross S3. There are also a couple of cases which are special and which haven't really been covered by the previous discussion, so they are like limiting cases. Limiting case where we set this constant C to zero, you recover T11. And another limiting case when you set A to one, and C is now arbitrary because you can rescale it by a change of coordinates, one recovers S5. So before summarizing what we have here, I just want to comment on a point here, which is one might object that, so you had perfectly nice solutions in type 2A and in M theory. You didn't do any fancy analysis involving integers. So why are you doing this now? So what's going on? Well, the reason is that when you do a T-duality, there is an interchange of what is classical on one side, what is quantum on the other side. So on type 2A and M theory side, what you should do is really to quantize the fluxes in order to be able to make sense as a string theory background. And it must be quite clear that this flux quantization condition is exactly equivalent to the global analysis, which we have done on the type 2B side, because the U1 connection is just something which will appear in the B field on the other side. So the B field will be proportional to this U1 part plus something which is harmless. So we can summarize now what we have found. We have found a family of infinitely many new Sasaki-Einstein matrix, which we denote YPQ, which are all on S2 cross S3, and they admit this isometry, as it's quite easy to see from the explicit form of the matrix. They are generically irregular, but one can show that it's possible to have also quasi-regular examples by imposing this type of Diophantine equation, which I'm not sure you can see because of these colors. In some sense, these metrics also interpolate between T11 and S5. So that's also another interesting feature. So in the last 5 or 10 minutes remaining, I'm going to turn to the most speculative part of the story, which we didn't cover in the works, but which I believe is perhaps one of the most interesting aspects of this story. That is, given that we now have a new Sasaki instance metrics in 5 dimensions and also in 7 and higher, as I mentioned, it's very natural to try and use them in the ADS-CFT correspondence and identify the field theory duals, which must be supersymmetric with n equal 1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. So here we are, as in the original paper by Klebanow and Witten, where they studied T11, as you may well know, that there have been many developments after that paper. One can possibly deform that solution, find RG flows, and so on and so on. So it seems like it's an interesting thing to do. So this slide is just to recall briefly what's really by now very obvious to everyone, what the ADS-CFT tells us. If we have ADS5 cross X5, where X5 is a Sasaki Einstein, Maldacena tells us that in the larger limit, this must be in the larger limit of a corresponding gauge theory, this must be dual to this theory. And the reason is that it arises at the tip of the cone over these manifolds, which must be Calabi-Yau almost by definition. And one can place the three brains at the tip of this cone. Now, the isometries of the internal manifolds, which are all under control for our cases because we have the explicit metrics, they correspond in general to flavor symmetries of the superconformal field theory. In fact, more precisely, the full isometry algebra comprises two terms, one which is responsible for the symmetry of ADS. So this is just the superconformal algebra, which contains a U1, which corresponds to the R symmetry in the field theory and a U1 isometry in the manifold. And in addition, there are other non-R flavor symmetries, which are the isometries of the additional isometries of the manifold. So for instance, in the T11 case, the full isometry group of T11 is S2 cross S2 cross U1. You have the U1R, and plus you have these two S2 factors, which make up your non-R F flavor symmetries. Another ingredient which I want to remind you is that the central charges, which happen to be the same C and A, I don't have time here to go into the details, but these are defined in terms of correlation functions and so on. They are inversely proportional to the volumes. So that's why the volumes are interesting objects to compute, and perhaps the most trivial thing to compute given a manifold. Okay, so T11 is very well understood. One can argue that the superconformal field theory dual corresponds to an SUN cross USUN theory with chiral fields in the B fundamentals of these two groups and a very specific superpotential W. One can compute also, of course, the central charge, which is given by a rational fraction of the central charge corresponding to n equal 4 theory, which is dual to the 5 sphere. And of course, there are many other things one can do. But for us, now this information will be enough to discuss the relevant features of our solutions. And the reason is that I'm going to put down now a field theory slide, as I named it, because this is completely now field theory results, which are not due to me, but are due to interligator and Quecht. I'm not sure how to pronounce, sorry, I apologize. And so quite recently, in fact, not even a year ago, they came up with some very interesting results in the context of four-dimensional superconformal field theory with n equals 1 supersymmetry. And these are the results which they have obtained. So they have obtained a way to identify exactly the R symmetry of n equals 1 superconformal field theory by using a maximization principle. So this is the more or less the recipe. And I'm sure you'll hear about this in string theory conference, because I think Intelligator is going to talk about this. So the method is the following. One uses, first of all, some formulas for the central charges A and C, which are given in terms of some traces of, here there's an R missing. These R generators. And so these are formulas which are valid for any conformal field theory in the four dimensions and supersymmetric. And one considers a trial R symmetry, which is given by an R symmetry R naught, which is a good R symmetry, which means it obeys all the possible constraints which come from unitarity, anomaly, cancellation conditions, and so on. So one assigns some trial R charges to the various fields of the theory, and consider a general linear combination with all the other flavor non-R symmetries in the theory with coefficients S, which are a priori just real numbers. Okay, the result that they prove, so it's a theorem, is that the exact R symmetry is the one which maximizes the central charge A among all these possible ones. So this is obtained demonstrating that these two formulas must be obeyed. So these two conditions can be naturally interpreted as a maximization conditions, because this is the vanishing of the gradient of this function A, and this is make sure that the Hessian is negative, so that U1 is at a local maximum of this function A. So this is, I believe, is a very interesting result, and it's quite also interesting that it ties up nicely with the results we have. Of course, this should be elaborated more, but we have the main ingredients. So in fact, the corollary of this result is that any n equal 1 super conformal field theories, if one uses this equation here, turns out to be algebraic, as they call it, which means that all the central charges, so A and C, and all the R symmetry charges must be square roots of rational numbers, because you have a quadratic to solve. So you are reduced to solving for numbers which are square roots of integers and fractions. So you might think that this is a very exotic case, which probably is not realized very often. It's pathological. But as Intelligator in fact show in the original work, and also as it is shown in some subsequent publications of people working in the field, this is a very general example. I mean, that's the generic case, is that the case in which these central charges are really irrational. And as an example which I just reported here, one can consider a quite simple quiver theory, which is U1 to the fourth, with zero superpotential. So you might expect this to be quite a simple theory. And if one applies the recipe of Intelligator and Vect, it turns out that the central charge A is exactly an irrational number. So there is a square root of 5, which is quite strange, at least to me. If one didn't know about this recipe. In fact, another reason why this is quite strange is that the very same theory with now a different superpotential has been argued to be dual to T11 mod Z2. So another example which has been worked out in the old days by Morrison and Plesser and other people. And one can show by using the ADS-CFT correspondence, or equivalently by using the recipe of Intelligator and Vect, that the central charge is exactly this one, which is a rational number, and so it's everything under control. So the same theory, just by changing the superpotential, has two different central charges. One is irrational, one is rational. So this is an example of how probably very spread and very many examples of these theories are out there. So in the context of ADS-CFT, and now we come back to our results, how am I going to find the CFT duals of a theory which has a irrational central charges? I'm not certainly going to find it among the regular Sasaki Einsteins, because as I argued, they have all volumes which are rationals. So I must look into the class of irregular spaces. So for instance, this example of integrator in vect, if it has any chance, it's not sure. It's not clear that every conformal field theory has an NDS-CFT dual, of course. But if it has, it must be in the class of irregular manifold. So who knows? It might even be in the class we have. I haven't checked yet. We don't know yet. But before giving a detailed analysis of superconformal field theories, which we have, which is not completely trivial for the reason which I mentioned in a moment, I can tell you some general properties that which we can infer from our results and which match the results in the field theory. So we have here an isometric group, which is SU2 cross U1 cross U1R, as I argued, where this U1R is contained in general into U1 cross U1. So in general, your symmetry has a U1 cross U1, and it's up to you to find out which is the R symmetry. Well, the R symmetry in the context of the DSCFT, it's easy to identify because it corresponds to the canonical Killing vector of Sasaki Einstein. So to make a parallel with the previous transparency, recall that we had some R which was proportional to some R tri zero, so R trial R zero plus a combination of F, which were flavor, other flavor symmetry. So now here I'm not arguing that there is any proof, but it's very suggestive that in fact, in the same way as in the field theory, one is led to consider linear combination of various U1R symmetries. In the same way we have that in the case of in the geometry picture, we have to consider a linear combination of the various U1 R symmetries of the theory in order to detect the correct real the proper R symmetry. And this obviously also matches with the result above the sensor charges, which I've shown you before. So the volumes are proportional to this number, which is an irrational one, and the volumes are algebraic in general, so they are square roots of rational numbers, and they are rational numbers if and only if the manifold is quasi-regular. So on the top line, we have the geometry, and on the bottom line, you have superconformal field theories. So R charges are irrational if and only if central charges C and A are irrational. It corresponds to the matching of the volumes and the Killing vector direction, which is good. So potentially here we have some interesting results to take into account and develop further. There are obviously many open questions. There are obviously many open questions because we don't know anything about the cones over these manifolds, and we don't know anything about the. We know something about the general properties of the gauge theory duals, but we don't know exactly what's the gauge group, superpotential, and so on. And these questions are obviously tied together. Do I have time for the conclusions? Okay, thanks. In fact, these are not really conclusions. This is just a list of things one can do as follow-ups of the results I presented. The most interesting one to me is to identify the dual conformal field theories. And I stress that because these are BPS supersymmetric solutions, there is a good chance that we can identify them. And one can insist on this observation that it seems we have something similarly to the gravity dual of A maximization and make this precise, investigate the Calabi-Yau cones, or do something else with this matrix, deform them, and so on. And as a last thing I would like to mention, on the which has been left out of the talk, is that we have a recipe and to construct new Sasaki-Einstein manifold in all dimensions, and perhaps one can go also develop this direction, which is perhaps more mathematical and of less physical interest, but still perhaps interesting. So I've finished. Thanks.
Is there questions? Are there questions?
We can have lunch.
I think I understood that you mentioned that the central charge can be rational or irrational according to the superpotential that you introduce into the dual theory.
Yeah.
So these irrational central charges that you got at the end in the almost last transparency, do you know to which superpotential they correspond to? Or
the example I've shown to you is given in intelligation of act, and it's in fact with zero superpotential.
No, but I mean the in the following transparency, in which you have this irregular
yes. All the examples I have, no, I don't know. It's an open question to identify the conformal field theories and the superpotentials.
I see. Okay, thanks. Are there further questions? So let's thank Dario again. And we go for lunch.